All glory, Lord, and honour to thee, Redeemer King. Father, we pray that tonight all glory and honour would indeed go to you. Amen. Well, we come in this second session to the medieval period. 500 to 1500 AD, 1,000 years. It's a long time. But like our imaginary walk around the British Museum, we'll be able only to stop at certain points. And of course, 500 and 1500 are artificial dates because true history is a seamless flow of myriads of events and streams all flowing into one great river. It just helps us to break it up into bite-sized chunks. But there are two huge events that kick-start this period, which we looked at last week. The rise of the papacy, if you want a church perspective, and the fall of the Roman Empire in 410, if you want a secular perspective. But does anyone know what brought the medieval period to an end, to a close, around the 1500s? No? From a church perspective, the Reformation. And from a secular perspective, it was quite a long period that this movement was the Renaissance. The Renaissance, yeah. They come at roughly at the same time at the end of that 15th century and the beginning of the 16th century, and they're not unconnected. The word medieval tends to conjure up in people's minds dark Gothic images of witch hunts, superstitious peasants, monks floating prayerfully through monastery cloisters or growing turnips in the monastery gardens. And Philip Schaff, the great historian from the end of the 19th century in his History of the Christian Church, summarizes the period well. All men believed in the supernatural and miraculous as readily as children do now. Heaven and hell were as real to the mind as the Kingdom of France and the Republic of Venice. Skepticism and infidelity, that's unbelief, were almost unknown, or at least suppressed and concealed. But with faith was connected a vast deal of superstition and an entire absence of critical investigation and judgment. Faith was blind and unreasoning, like the faith of children. The most incredible and absurd legends were accepted without a question. There was certainly a repressiveness and a lack of knowledge. But it's not the whole story. It's not probably even the best way to picture it. The medieval period was really characterized by power struggles between the church and the state. After Constantine and the Edict of Toleration, Christianity became a legal religion, and Constantine began to turn the Roman Empire into a Christian empire. In the following decades, it seemed like revival, massive church growth, wonderful new church buildings, changes in laws and customs, church leaders taking on political and social roles, Constantine ruling as a Christian emperor. By the end of the 4th century, Christianity had become the state religion, the only legal religion, and it was pagans who were being persecuted. And under the papacy, the marriage between church and state became known as Christianitas, Christendom, an unholy alliance between church and state that would dominate Europe for over 1,000 years and that still impacts the way Christians think and act. But we need to recognise that the sacral papal system, when the Pope ruled religiously and politically, actually kept Europe from disintegrating after the fall of the Roman Empire. Christendom became the unifying force within Europe. Prior to this, the emperor was the unifying force, requiring everyone to proclaim Caesar as Lord. Indeed, Christendom can be said even to define Western civilization. What makes Western civilization Western civilization? The church under the papacy gave Western civilization its structure and cohesiveness over the next 1,000 years. Not sure it continued, but it certainly made the difference then. So during the early Middle Ages, 500 to 1000, the bishops in Rome continued to gain power. You'll remember there were five great metropolises, or metropolis. What's the word? You can tell me afterwards. Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, and Jerusalem. Now, Rome in the west and Constantinople in the east gained greater prominence because of their locations. And as the power of the bishops grew in these two cities, so did the controversy over which these two cities should have supremacy. You remember Damasus and Leo I and Gregory the Great. Their episcopal powers increased for bishops of Rome more and more. And whether or not the early church father Cyprian actually taught the idea of Roman supremacy as a matter of debate, some say he did, some say he didn't. Nevertheless, you might have picked up on Newsnight, of course, just over 2 weeks ago on the day that Pope Benedict XVI announced his resignation. No, what did he say? He renounced his papacy. There's an important difference there. On the 11th of February, Michael Walsh, albeit a liberal Catholic, a member of Opus Dei, said it would be no good having a South American pope because that would make him a CEO, which is precisely what we don't want. What we need, he said, is to go back to having a Bishop of Rome who doesn't have to rule the whole Catholic Church. Very interesting. So the idea is there out there at the moment. It's interesting in the light of the papal origins, and also when we come to consider the problem of the popes in Avignon later on in the 14th century. Nevertheless, the papacy continued to add to its powers into the Middle Ages. And when Boniface III was consecrated in 607, Roman papacy became universally accepted. Many other bishops followed his legacy of runners for supremacy. And much later in 1703, when Hildebrand, whose papal name was Gregory VII, reformed the papacy, he too greatly enhanced his powers. His new laws stressed the absolute sovereignty of the church in this world. It was a theocracy based on the theocracy of Israel under Moses. And he went so far as to use excommunication and the papal interdict as weapons against the ruler of the state. He thus rejected Augustine's City of God idea, teaching on the distinction between the visible and the invisible church, and said that the kingdom of God, or the city of God, is found in the visible church of Christ on earth. Then finally, under Innocent III, that's still just looking ahead a bit, jumping ahead to 1161 and so on, papal power reached its ultimate power. He claimed absolute, spiritual and temporal authority over the Holy Roman Empire. He ruled the lot. But let's leave papacy aside for the moment and go east to the Silk Road to China. Roads have always been important, not just for the transport of exotic merchandise and foods, but also for the spread of ideas and, of course, religion. The Silk Road was one such road, a 5,000-mile trade route that extended from the ancient capital of China in Chang'an, that's modern-day Xi'an, where they discovered the terracotta soldiers, to all the way to Byzantium in Turkey, that's Constantinople or Istanbul. And it led to the spread of Chinese technology in a westward direction, like silkworm breeding, iron smelting, and papermaking, but it also brought Buddhism and Christianity to China. Now, in China, the Tang Dynasty in the 7th to 9th century was a very important period in Chinese history because of its openness to new ideas and religions. Up to that time, the Silk Road had been closed because of hostility from surrounding nations, but by the year 630, all hostile neighboring nations had either been subdued by force or surrendered peaceably. The Emperor Tang Taizong was able to proclaim the route to Persia is reopened. All our enemies have surrendered. Now merchants are safe to travel. You also need to know that the Emperor Tang Taizong was a military man and not a scholar and did not want the Confucianists, the intellectual classes, to control society. So he welcomed new philosophies and religions and adopted an open attitude towards Buddhism, Islam, Judaism and the Jingzhou. Now, in God's great providence, this opening of the roads and openness to foreign ideas also opened the way for a Syrian monk and Nestorian bishop called Alapen to come as a missionary to China. In 635, he arrived in the capital city of Chang'an and was welcomed by the emperor himself. In line with this policy of toleration, the emperor gave Alapen permission to translate the 30 Christian books he bought from Persia He also assigned to him 21 Buddhist monks to help him in the work of translation and allowed them to do it, no less, in the imperial library. The fact that the first translators of Christian writings were Buddhist monks explains why so many Buddhist expressions and terminology are found in the earliest Christian books in China. 3 years later, in 638, Alapan completed the first Christian book in Chinese, the Sutra, that's just the book, of Jesus the Messiah. Su Ting Mishi Shuo Jing. I think the Mishi Shuo is the Messiah word. And in this book, it was carefully argued that Christianity was part, listen to this, was part of China's ancient tradition and designed to help the Chinese emperor understand the new religion that they were trying to propagate. And since the emperor permitted Christianity to flourish by edict in 638, it must have been composed about those 3 years. And he also provided for the first building of a church. Now, interestingly, until quite recently, it was thought that Christianity was just a small part of the religious scene in China and in Japan. In fact, until the 1600s, the only testimony to Christianity in China was a stone tablet in the city of Chang'an called the Nestorian Monument, sometimes called the Rosetta Stone of Christianity. And I've given you on the sheet a little pictorial depiction of the top of that. The rest of it actually looks like the Rosetta Stone. It's black with white engraving. The thing that's always puzzled scholars is that it clearly states on the monument, oh, by the way, you'll see at the top of it a cross. But it clearly states on the monument that, quote, monasteries abound in 100 cities. But where were these monasteries? Until recently, this was the only proof of a Christian past, but the recent discovery of a church building, not just in Chang'an, but at the centre of the imperial compound itself, presumably the one ordered by Tang Taizong in 638, appears to confirm the inscription on the Nestorian monument and the fact that Christianity was indeed a central aspect of Chinese life at the time. And the staff at the Keikaiyo Institute, is that how you pronounce it? Keikaiyo Institute, which works to establish the proper history of Christianity in Asia, confirms that. Now, why is all this history so important? The answer is this. In Asia, history counts. To offer to individuals and to areas a gospel that has no connection with them is extremely difficult. But to offer a gospel that can be shown to be the faith of their fathers, calling them not to accept a new religion but to go back, is completely different. In fact, there's a suggestion that there's an even deeper connection to the past. In the Chinese story of the flood, in a text from 200 BC by a man called Huai Nan Zi, the character for the word ark is very interesting, and I've put it on the sheet. The Chinese use characters which represent the object they're describing, and this character is a combination of three Chinese other characters. The first part of the character means a vessel, the second part means eight, the third part means mouth, or person. In other words, eight people in the boat. This character was used in the Chinese story of the flood from 200 BC. And in the Bible account, of course, the total number of people in the ark was eight, Noah and his family. After the flood, you see, the human race was scattered over the face of the whole earth. You remember that from the Bible story. So we sort of expect, wouldn't we, to find the same story told in every nation, or a strong memory of it through oral tradition. So in fact, Christianity in China goes back over 2,000 years. Anyway, that's China. But in the 7th and 8th centuries AD, Christianity was an Eastern religion. There were probably twice as many Christians on the eastern side of the Holy Land, in Mesopotamia, Persia, India, China, Japan, and Central Asia, and Tibet, than on the western side in Europe and North Africa. And then during the second millennium, Christianity declined in the Eastern world largely because of Islam, and became more associated with European culture. Which brings us to the rise of Islam. which originated with a man called Muhammad in the Arabian Peninsula, but expanded rapidly with the Islamic Crusades, resulting in the formation of one of the most significant empires in history. Its area of influence stretched from the borders of China and the Indian subcontinent across Central Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, Sicily, and the Iberian Peninsula, that's Spain, and the Pyrenees in one large crescent. Muhammad was born in 570 and lived in Mecca for the first 52 years of his life, till 622. According to Muslim tradition, Muhammad began receiving revelations at the age of 40. After meeting Christians and Jews, he embraced monotheism and espoused generosity towards the poor, kind treatment, emancipation of slaves, and the equality between men and women before God. Despite all this, the clues we have about his actual life don't paint a noble picture. Charles Potter, the author of The Great Religious Leaders, writes, "His dislikes were just as varied. He detested silk-lined clothes," I don't know why that's a problem, "interest charges, dogs, others' lies, Jews and Christians. He hated poets and said, every painter will be in hell. Once he tortured a Jew to find the location of hidden treasure and then had him killed and added the widow to his harem. Strange indeed was the character of the prophet. How could such a person inspire such reverence and devotion? It is one of the puzzles of history." Of course, some respected his ideas and became followers. Many others, including tribal leaders, opposed, ridiculed, and eventually boycotted his clan. And Muhammad and his followers were harassed, assaulted, tortured, and forced into exile. Several attempts were made on his life. And in June 622, warned of a plot to assassinate him, Muhammad secretly escaped from Mecca with Abu Bakr and went to Medina in the great flight to Medina. But where did the notion of jihad or holy war come from? According to one website I read, it's a myth that the pagans at Mecca were the first to draw blood. The Muslims were actually the first to resort to physical violence when Sa'd bin Abu Waqqas picked up a camel's jawbone and struck a local polytheist who was rudely interrupting his group of praying Muslims. Ibn Ishaq, in his biography of Muhammad, written at the time, says this was the first blood to be shed in Islam. Indeed, the Muslims themselves honour Sa'd for his actions, and you can read about it on the Beautiful Islam website. This spirit of revenge is found in the Quran, although written much later than this, probably written around about 750, not 650 as you often hear. You can ask about that later. The Quran in Surah 2, that's chapter 2, 191, says, "And slay them," that's the unbelievers, the infidels, "wherever ye find them, and drive them out of the places whence they drove you out. For persecutions," that's persecutions of Muslims, "is worse than slaughter of non-believers. But if they desist, then lo, Allah is forgiving and merciful, and fight them until persecution is no more. And religion is for Allah." Well, the historical context of that passage cannot be defensive warfare, since Muhammad and his Muslims had just relocated to Medina and were not under the attack by their Meccan adversaries. In fact, these verses urge offensive warfare, in that Muslims are to drive Meccans out of their own city, which they later did. There were no armies marching against them, nor any plans for such. The Meccans had no influence in this faraway town, and Muslims were not under persecution at the time. It is an unpleasant historical fact that in the 10 years that Muhammad lived in Medina, he either sent out or went out on 74 raids, expeditions, or full-scale wars, which ranged from small assassination hit squads to the Tabuk Crusade. It might surprise you that Muhammad was the first to launch a crusade. But under the banner of religion, that's what a crusade is, Muhammad launched a crusade in 630 with 30,000 men and 10,000 horsemen to Tabuk. So he obviously rallied a lot of recruits in that time, a city in the north of Saudi Arabia. In fact, the Byzantine army failed to materialize. So Muhammad and his large army had to turn around and go home without having to fight. That's one way to defeat your... To throw off your enemy, isn't it? Just don't turn up. But the long-term consequence of this crusade was that many Arab tribes now abandoned the Byzantines and joined with Muhammad, enlarging the Muslim state. The tide of Arab expansion, or Muslim expansion after 630, rolled through North Africa, wiping out all those indigenous Christian communities in Tunisia and Egypt and Ethiopia with those early church fathers from North Africa, Athanasius and Cyprian and others, and Augustine as well from Hippo, those communities, and went up to as far as Morocco. And then, with the Roman Empire beginning to fragment into multiple principalities, Europe itself was ripe for conquest and expansion. The first to experience Islam's threat was the Iberian Peninsula, which consisted of Spain and Portugal, Gibraltar, Andorra, and a place called Septimania, which I've not heard of. It sounds like a disease. Septimania. At the time, populated by a Germanic tribe called the Visigoths. And in 711, landing in Gibraltar, the Umayyads, that was the name given to the Muslims at the time, they quickly conquered Spain and began to move into France until they were stopped at Poitiers in 732, the Battle of Poitiers, or Tours, by a man called Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer. And he was the king of the Franks. They were also known, by the way, as Moors, and included sort of Arabs and Berbers and North African peoples. What motivated the Muslim conquest is much disputed, but we have the words of Ibn Khaldun, a medieval statesman, jurist, historian and scholar from 1332 to 1406. Khaldun wrote a history that is still admired by historians today. He writes what seems an obvious point. In the Muslim community, the holy war is a religious duty because of the universalism of the Muslim mission and the obligation to convert everybody to Islam, either by persuasion or by force. He acknowledges that when the Islamic crusaders go to war, the army's mission, besides material gain, is to convert the inhabitants. Islam is a universalizing religion, and if its converts enter its fold either by persuasion or force, then that is the nature of Islam. Now, back in the West, we're sort of in the West, aren't we? But we come chronologically to one of the most significant periods of Western civilization, the period of Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire. And I'm depending very much here on Brian Borgman, who has a doctorate from Westminster Seminary in the States, but a very important period of history in the build-up to the Crusades. And it begins with a fellow by name of Boniface, a missionary from Devon. The name Boniface means doer of good. But Boniface, 680 to 764, wasn't his real name. It was Winfrid or Winfrith. And after working in Frisia for a while, he returned and then decided that God was calling him to evangelize the Germans, the rough and ready tribe that wreaked havoc throughout the Roman Empire. And Winfrid became known as the Apostle to the Germans. And as the Apostle to the Germans, he went to one of their tribes, according to legend, and may well be true, and while ministering to them, he noticed one tribe had an oak tree that was designated a symbol of Thor. They actually worshipped the oak tree. Boniface did his best to preach against the idolatry, but they were utterly unpersuaded by his preaching. So he decided with a few of his friends to take axes to the tree. And as they began to chop into the tree, of course, the tribes watched with horror, fearful of what was about to happen. And as they watched, a huge storm blew in, and the tribes wondered if this would be Boniface's end and those helping him desecrate their idol. But instead, with no harm to Boniface and his men, the storm came and blew the oak tree into four pieces. At that point, that particular tribe began to listen to Boniface and embrace the gospel. Boniface was a very earnest and sincere man, and on one occasion he was baptizing a number of brand new converts, and an opposing army came down, and the times were very bloody at that time and violent, and the men being baptized, of course, got ready to fight and defend themselves. And Boniface told them to put down their swords because they would take the posture of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And as he continued baptizing and finished the service, they knelt down at the river. The tribe came down and slaughtered Boniface and the 51 brand new converts. This brought Boniface to an end, but he was a tremendous missionary. And through his efforts to reorganize and regulate the Church of the Franks, he helped shape Western Christianity and many of the dioceses he proposed remain until this day. And that brings us to another character of the time, a fellow called Pepin. And we're dealing here with Pepin the Short, in case you confuse him with some other Pepin. You think I'm joking. Charles Martel, you remember, Charles the Hammer, who turned back the Muslims at Poitiers, had two sons, Carloman and Pepin. And he, being a very devout man, put both his sons into a monastery, and after Martel's death, they came to share the throne of France. At that time, they realized that the Franks needed to be evangelized, and they came to share the throne of France. They asked Boniface to come and help them reform the Frankish church and evangelize the Franks. At some point, Carloman decided to stay in a monastery, leaving Pepin to rule France on his own. When I say ruled the Franks, at that point in history, it wasn't quite true, because they already had a king called Childeric III, and he belonged to the very weak Merovingian dynasty. But in practice, it was Pepin who really ruled de facto and effectively, putting down several rebellions. We could then subtitle this period as Pepin and the Pope, because in 751, Pepin gets fed up with pretending to be the king. He gets the support of Pope Zacharias, who puts pressure on to depose Childeric III. Childeric agrees to the idea. He's obviously been planning his retirement for a while, and his pension's about to mature, and he decides to join a monastery. And probably not the same monastery as the one Carloman went to. There were plenty of people who went into exile into monasteries. They must have been full of them. So he didn't die, he didn't get executed, he just joined a monastery. But then the Pope gets Boniface, Saint Boniface, to crown Pepin as the King of France. Now this is a pretty amazing thing in history, which has three big results. It's the beginning of the Carolingian dynasty, which would have a huge impact on Western civilization. Secondly, the Pope, for the first time, claimed that his apostolic authority extended to actually deposing and appointing kings, albeit through a representative. And this will be a very, very significant thing in the course of Western history. And thirdly, the Carolingian dynasty would owe its governing authority to the papacy itself. Shortly after this, the Lombards were threatening to invade Rome, and Pope Zacharias informs Pepin, "Look, I gave you a throne, you better help me." Pepin defeats the Lombards, which also has implications for today, because Pepin gave all the conquered Lombard cities to the Pope, and those conquered Lombard cities to this day are papal states that are independent states in Italy. He has a kingdom on earth. Now this brings us to Pepin's son, Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, Charles Magnus, 742 to 814, who ruled for the next 43 years. Charles the Great was one of the truly colossal figures of history. Often compared to Constantine the Great, he recreated the Roman Empire on a Christian basis and is described as the Moses of the Middle Ages because he brought the German tribes out of the wilderness to give them a new code of civil and ecclesiastical laws. A physical giant of a man, but a just and generous ruler, affectionate father, sincere devotion to the Christian faith, and highly popular with his subjects. A burning sense of personal mission for God to unite the Western nations under a Christian empire. The only real fault was his imperfect standard of sexual misconduct. He married and divorced several wives at will, and after the death of his fifth wife, he took a number of concubines. A somewhat glaring fault. But he was probably not alone. He was also an outstanding military leader. He made himself the king of the Lombards and added northern Italy to his kingdom. He beat the Muslims in Barcelona. He conquered the German pagans in Hungary. And after 30 long years, he finally defeated the Saxons. After this victory, he gave the Saxons a choice: accept Christian baptism or die. Of course, most of them accepted when they felt the tip of the sword. But this was his policy throughout his reign: accept Christian baptism or die. It's told that he would take troops yet to be baptized and run them through rivers, proclaiming them to be baptized on the other side in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Thankfully, at the latter end of his reign, he did change his methods. Now Charlemagne would become the emperor and give rebirth to an empire. Charlemagne and the Pope end up having an interesting relationship. It begins on Christmas Day in 800. His kingdom was said to be a recreation of the Roman Empire in the West. This led to Charlemagne being recognized as the Roman Emperor in 800. The man behind this move was Pope Leo III. On Christmas Day, while Charlemagne was kneeling at the rail in St. Peter's Church in Rome, receiving communion, he was surrounded by Frankish nobles and clergymen. Without warning, Pope Leo suddenly produces a crown and places it on his head. The report from history is that Charlemagne was apparently unaware of what was about to happen. Did the Pope just pull a crown from under his robe and pop it on his head? At that point, Leo's men stand up and shout three times, "To Charlemagne, Augustus, long life and victory." Augustus, of course, being the name of one of the early Roman emperors. And thus was born the Holy Roman Empire, with the Pope having been behind it all. But as Voltaire said a number of years later, sardonically, it was neither holy nor Roman, he was Frankish, nor an empire. This Christmas Day event signified that Charlemagne was no longer just the king of the Franks, but the heir of the old Roman emperors, the supreme ruler of the Western world. But more intriguing is that this new Roman emperor owed his position to the papacy. Leo was determined to make the emperor dependent on the Pope for his imperial status. Now, of course, Charlemagne was pleased with his new position, but unhappy with the way Leo had done it. He tried to kill off the idea that he owed his authority to the Pope. He believed himself to be not just the ruler of the empire, but ruler of the church. This unusual coronation thus set the stage for an enduring power struggle between the church and the state. At which point I think we'll break again, because we're on pews, so we'll stop and perhaps have a think about what we've seen so far.